This is a powerful little letter that Paul writes to one of his young pastors in training, one of the young guys he calls a true son in the faith, guy that, you know, was a little tougher than Timothy. Timothy was a little on the meek side and had to be encouraged in one sense, where Titus, you know, was given an assignment that would have probably been the equivalent of going into Harlem and the worst part of town, or going into Brooklyn and some of the worst parts of town and starting a ministry and grabbing some of these guys right off the street and saying, okay, now we're going to make, are you a pastor? We're going to do you an elder. We're going to do you over here and we're going to train you guys. And Titus got a tough assignment. I can just see, you know, the people, the response in Crete. In fact, we already read how one of their own said that they were, what was the record that we saw here? One of their own prophets of themselves, verse 12 said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. That was a 600-year-old prophecy, actually, from a poet that actually was a Greek, but he was from the island of Crete, and said these guys were the worst people in the Grecian Empire, and described them, and Paul kind of agrees, yeah, this testimony's still true. These guys are still bad. So these guys, this is a tough assignment, and we left off, at verse 5, where he says, I left you in Crete that you should set in order the things that are lacking and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you. And we kind of ran through 6 to the end just to get the feel of the flow of the whole letter, but I want to go back to verse 6 and pick up there and look at what he was referring to. Now, if he's going to assign or appoint elders, he does have a tough task. Well, what's the criteria? What is an elder? Well, we looked at an elder in the sense of what it meant it was, that here is a guy who is given charge and responsibility over the church. It's synonymous with bishop, which one is basically an overseer. He's there overseeing, but the description throughout the scriptures is really that of a servant who is enabling others to, you know, be equipped for the work of ministry. For example, the purpose of God giving apostles and prophets and evangelists and pastor teachers is for the equipping of the saints for the work of the ministry, so that all the people involved in the church get involved in the work of the ministry, where they're all ministering and they're all ministers in some capacity, but some people are specially called to equip them. Well, elders really are to be appointed in every city. And an elder and a pastor really is synonymous in many respects. As the elders are laid hands on here, really they're pastoring. They're in the role of a pastor. They're ministering the Word of God. They're counseling in the Scriptures. They're giving insight. They're praying for the various needs. They're lifting up those things, and they're watching out for the flock. Which, you know, when Paul, if you remember when he went to Ephesus in one of his journeys in Acts chapter 20, a powerful testimony of his heart as he explained to them that they should take heed to themselves and watch out over themselves. And then he says, and then take heed to the flock, you know, that you minister to the flock. And then he says, and take heed to the wolves. In other words, you've got, as an elder or a pastor, to not only watch yourself, because that's your tool. If you're dull, if there's something missing in your own life, that character deficiency is going to be reflected in others too. Secondly, you've got to watch out over the flock and feed the flock and minister and take care of the needs and be sensitive to those things. And then you've got to watch out for the wolves, because that is a reality. As a church grows especially, people come in, and just as Jesus spoke about how the kingdom of God was like a little mustard seed that grows into a large tree and the birds of the air nest in its branches. We should not be so naive as to think that just because someone is attending here at Calvary Chapel, that they're all right on, because they may not be. Of course, elders and overseers are to observe carefully and watch and pray with the gifts of the Spirit, of discerning of spirits, to tell where someone is at and confront those who are unruly and etc. So there's some very important tasks here. Now, in the three pastoral letters that Paul wrote between AD 63 and 67, this one in particular has a number of things about criteria, or actually qualifications for these elders, that are very similar to the letter that he wrote to 1 Timothy. But let's jump in verse 6 and start working our way through some of these qualifications, because it's important to know. And I believe the need, especially not only then in Crete, the need today is for more real leaders in many areas. We get requests from all over from the radio program. We would love to have a Calvary Chapel up here, over here. Is there a church that I can go to? I started listening to your broadcast and got saved. Is there a church you can recommend? And in many respects, you know, there's a lot of good churches all over, but there's a great lack in many areas also. And we have a special burden and care for this whole New York, New Jersey area, that God would raise up those from among us, and that as they're equipped and fed and trained to be sent out and to be used of the Lord. And you know, it's not a matter of having to go through years of seminary and years of training. If you've got a heart that's willing and teachable, God is going to equip you. You know, I didn't go to seminary. I shouldn't do that. I'm not against it in the one sense. I just think it's better to learn on the job. You know, instead of being cloistered away for many years and then you come out and you have a lot of education but no practical experience, that's not very good. Then it takes you years to develop that, and by that time you've forgotten everything you learned in seminary. So, I'm sorry, it just comes out by habit, I guess. You really need to realize that God has called you to risk. He's going to give you that calling. He'll equip you. He'll train you. And, you know, in many respects, it's very important to have that foundation, you know. The Marines say they're looking for a few good men, and, you know, I think the Lord is desiring that. Where are the men? He desires men to be raised up in ministry. All the world is desperate for a good leader, a good man in a good area. I had a laugh at this illustration. In the recreation room of a California retirement facility, four ladies were playing bridge and chatting and keeping an eye on the flow of people coming in and out of the area. And an elderly gentleman wandered in the room, and they recognized him as a newcomer. And so they all perked up. And one of the ladies said, oh, you're new here, aren't you? And he smiles and says, yeah, I just moved in this morning. And one of the other ladies said, well, where did you live before you moved in? And he says, well, I was just released from San Quentin, where I spent the last 20 years. And the third lady perks up at this and says, oh, is that so? Well, what were you in for? And he says, I murdered my wife. And the fourth lady sits up in her chair and smiles and says, oh, then you're single. That's what I would call desperate. Well, you know, the Lord knows who are His. And He has plans for those who He wants to equip in ministry. So He's not desperate in that sense. But I think the church, when you look at the state of the church, these are desperate times. When you see the expression of the church in the community, it's amazing how people, the average person, views the church these days. It's sad, isn't it? I mean, when you tell someone, hey, you got to come to my church, and you really love it, it's really cool, and they look at you like, you're weird. You enjoy going to church? They can't understand that. Unfortunately, that is an oddity. Unfortunately, that is, but it shouldn't be. The church should have a testimony throughout the community in many different areas that is the happening place. That's where real, you know, social structure takes place, because you've got real communion and koinonia with people. Unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of bad examples. So hence the need for those people to be raised up. And of course, especially in the area of Crete, Titus is given this incredible, difficult charge. And now he says, this is what we're looking for. In verse 6, he says, if a man is blameless, well, let's stop there for a second. We're not going to get very far if we keep doing this, but unfortunately we have to, because in order to really understand what Paul is saying, we have to look at these words. These words are very important. If a man is blameless, well, the first thing that I see here is it's a man. A man is given that commission to be an elder in the church. You do not see any example in the scriptures of a woman being an elder. In fact, you see what Paul warns. He says, I do not permit a woman to teach or usurp authority over the man in 1 Timothy. He made that very plain in chapter 2, verse 12. But be careful of this, because submission about this in this area is often misunderstood to make people think it's a surrender of mind and conscience. Rather, it's a warning against usurping the authority. Now, it cannot mean that a woman can't teach at all or be in complete silence, because Priscilla and Aquila were good examples. They instructed Apollos, but in private. They instructed him in some points. Titus tells us later that older women are to teach the younger women. In fact, if you really think about it, it's kind of surprising to me that when you see the need for men in the church to be raised up in positions of leadership, that there are women with that ambition to be an elder, or be a pastor, or be that which the Bible has said very plainly, that's not their role, it surprises me, because if you think about the structure of the church, 2/3 of the church are women and children. It's not proper, really, for a man to be mentoring a woman. And in many respects, you've got 2/3 of the church that are women and children, so 2/3 of the church are open for ministry for women. Why would a woman desire then to intrude into that 1/3 in which there is a desperate lack of godly men to be raised up in those areas, and they need to be, and if women jump into those roles, then men don't? I think there is the problem. You see, this is the thing that is amazing. Many more women are available than men. Men need to rise to the challenge, to be aware, hey, this is a calling to me. This is a calling. This might be your calling even tonight as you hear this, that God has called you. What are you waiting for? You're waiting for your wife to be your spiritual guru. You're waiting for someone else to be called, and maybe someone else will do it. I have a problem with that. I really think, you know, again, I don't want any woman to feel that the role that God has given to them is insignificant when God has given them the opportunity to minister to 2/3 of the church. And seemingly lesser gifts, understand, are more important from God's economy. You're faithful in what God's called you to do, you'll be rewarded as such. But I think it's sad that men are not following up with that role. So Paul says to Titus, if a man is blameless... blameless. Used three times in 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy and also in Titus. Beyond reproach is the idea here. It doesn't mean that you could actually be perfect, and that's not what the term blameless means. But it means that you've come to a place where you're not open to attack. You've got no skeletons in your closet. There's no one that can actually point out something about you and accuse you of some scandalous thing that would really hinder your effectiveness as an example in the church. So you're blameless in that respect. Now understand, the reason you need to be blameless is because if you're a leader in the church, you're going to be a special target of Satan. He's going to target you. Why? Because if he can get you to fall, then he's going to stumble a whole lot of people who have been mentored by you or exampled, you know, Christ by you. That is a tough situation, and unfortunately that happens. You know, their fall, a leader's fall, has greater potential to affect others. The greater the truth that you receive, the greater the light brings the greater responsibility and accountability. And also the fact that as you profess a greater light and truth in being a leader in the church, it's even that much more hypocritical if somehow or another you're found out not to be what you profess to be. So this qualification makes total sense. Leader in the church needs more power and grace, but needs to be above reproach. You know, it's very important to consider this. He also goes on to say, the husband of one wife. Now, this reiterates the aspect that this is a man and not calling a woman, because a woman obviously could not be the husband of one wife. This is a qualification. This is a need for an elder. Now, I believe the reason this is so is because there is an example there. Now, in marriage, a lot of things are revealed in marriage. Marriage, to me, is like an amplifier. You get amplified when you get married. And when you're following the Lord and you're serving the Lord and the Lord adds a wife or a husband along, it's like it's an added blessing and an encouragement. And your ministry really is amplified. You're really walking, you're pulling twice or three, four times as much as you could if you were individuals pulling. Kind of like that horse pulling contest that they had. They had two horses that pulled, and one pulled 5,000 pounds and the other pulled 4,000 pounds. And then they put them together and they hitched them up together. And instead of just pulling 9,000 pounds, which would have been the addition, they were able to pull 12,000 pounds because they were working in tandem. And their labors were working, and that's kind of what happens in marriage. Now, when he says a husband of one wife, it's not referring to the fact that there would have been polygamy in that culture, because in the Grecian culture, that was not common among the average person, especially in the churches. That would not have been an issue. But it's not really referring to polygamy, but it's not forbidding a marrying after the death of a spouse, you know, because that's certainly plain in the scriptures, the opportunity to remarry if your spouse dies, or even certain cases, according to the scriptures, of divorce. Even in divorce, it's not an automatic disqualification. The Bible does not forbid all remarriages after divorce. If you read Matthew 5, you understand there is certain conditions for a divorce that God has allowed. Matthew 19:9, or when an unbelieving spouse initiates the divorce, the other person is not in bondage to remain unmarried, according to 1 Corinthians 7:15. However, God hates divorce. All divorce is a result of sin. And it does create a very difficult thing because, you know, to determine the innocent party is sometimes not an easy thing. And it's certainly not the role of any leader in the church to do. God is ultimately going to be the judge there. But when Paul speaks about being the husband of one wife, the idea there that's being presented is he's a one-woman man. He's not going to be adding other women and divorcing this woman and going to this woman. He's not going to be thinking about, you know, how can I get out of this marriage? He's going to be a one. He's committed. When he says, till death do us part, he means it. And especially in the church, you know, a man of God should be called, when he's married, to be faithful to that woman that he is married. To be faithful no matter what. False spirituality is often inept at the simpler graces. A false spiritual person can come here at Calvary and, man, they can pull on the old spiritual lingo and they can talk such stuff and they can look like they're so godly. And then you find out their wives are really struggling. And you scratch your head and go, wow, I would have never thought. But you know what? What you are at home is what you really are. Doesn't matter what you pretend to be here in the congregation of people, it's what you are at home is what you are. Live with that. And maybe make some changes there. Maybe think about how, if you're having devotions with your wife or you're praying with your wife, maybe think about some responsibility there. Think about taking the initiative to lead. Open up the scriptures. Let God speak to you and then minister to your wife. Be that leader. So the husband of one wife. Now, then he goes on to say, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. Now, there have been many leaders in the church whose children have rebelled. I mean, it's almost amazing how many that I can think of just offhand. Notable leaders whose children rebelled for a time but then came back. However, there is one thing that's very certain in your home. If your home is out of order, there's a problem. Eli is a case example in that. Back in 1 Samuel, remember, the Bible speaks about how the people were frustrated as Eli was getting older and older. They did not want one of his sons to rule over them because his sons were bad news. They were ripping the people off. They were sleeping with women. They were doing all kinds of things as the sons of Eli the priest. And they didn't want one of these guys to take, you know, charge after he was gone. That's why they wanted a king. That's why Samuel kind of raised up and eventually raised up Saul and then David eventually. But it was bad news with these guys, these sons of Eli. Now, the failure of Eli was in disciplining his sons, holding them to account. As a father, as a leader of your home, you can discipline your children and maybe they won't respond. And ultimately, you know, it might even be that you have to, you know, in keeping your house in order, part company. You know, you might have to tell your sons get to that age and they want to do their own thing. Well, hey, this house has got, you know, I want to keep my house in order. I want to keep it right. And if my children are going to rebel and do things, I don't want them to be covered over, under this, you know, home setting that they're going to be making a mockery. What a bad example that is. So you need to have your, you know, you need to have that authority in your children. And because, you know, the bottom line is, kids will understand it when you say, well, look, these are the rules of the home. You want to live here? These are the rules. Now, if they follow them, great. They're keeping themselves subordinate. They're keeping themselves in line. But if they don't want to follow those rules, then you say, see ya. I mean, how can you let them stay if they're not going to follow those rules? Because if you do let them stay, they will. What you're going to do is you're going to create a greater monster than you could ever imagine. Now you might think, well, gee, you know, if I tell them to leave and they go off and do, they're going to get really crazy without having that balance. Well, you see, you don't want to protect them from the choices they're making. Because the older they get, the harder the lessons will be. And if you shelter them in a home while they're living insubordinately and they're carrying on and they're doing things that are not right that you don't agree with, and there's, you know, that real rebellion there, the lesson they'll have to learn later in life will be devastating. Better to learn it when they're young, when they're in their late teens or, you know, early 20s. Better to learn it then. So I know a person who was bailed out by their parents when they did something wrong, and the parents, I think it was like he was a young guy, and his parents bailed him out, whatever the debt was that he got into, and then he got into a greater debt, and they bailed him out again, and then he got into an immense debt when he was in his 20s, and they bailed him out again, and the last time they couldn't bail him out, he went to jail. Now, had he not been bailed out in the beginning, had he been made to hold, you know, some accountability for that action, it might have prevented him from later on having to learn the hard way. So I think it's a good, important thing for a man to have his faithful children not accused of dissipation or insubordination. Now, dissipation, again, is that of excess, and insubordination would be rebellion. You know, rebellious attitude, you know, it's so prevalent in the world. Probably many of you right now are thinking, you know, I don't know how you get around that. I mean, all kids are rebellious to some degree. Well, they're going to be testing the waters, but here's where the rules are important. Here's where you've got to set a standard and say, this is who we are. Now, I could have been different, because if I wasn't a Christian, you would have been very sorry about that. I had to tell my son one time, you know, I said, you know, you're really parasiting off of the goodness of what God has done in this home. Because if I wasn't a Christian, I would kill you right now. Interesting. But kids need to learn. You know, they need to understand. So the husband of one wife having faithful children. And then, you know, he goes on to say, now speaking more, he says, for a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God. Again, the word bishop and the word elder are really synonymous when you follow through the scriptures. He must be blameless as a steward of God. Now, a church leader is a person whose word should be trusted. I mean, you should be able to trust what they say. Can't be inconsistent. Can't say one thing to one person and something contradictory to another person. His yes must be yes and his no, no. You have to ask, does he keep his promises? Is he hypocritical? Does he alter the truth to serve his own best interests? Does he slander people behind their backs? I mean, does he keep confidences? These things are aspects of, you know, being blameless as that overseer, as that steward of God. And then other qualifications, no personal qualifications, not self-willed. Now here's some of the knots. Here's some of the things that to be avoided. Now remember when we're reading these things, you know, might be sitting there thinking, you know, yeah, I'm going to keep a close watch on you and the elders in this church, Pastor. I'm going to make sure that you guys understand this. Yes, this is something we are to be modeling. At the same time, if we're modeling it, we're modeling it for what? Because it's not so much that you can look at these and go, well, I guess I'll never be an elder. You know, I'm not going to go down that road. I can't do that. Then you're missing the point. We're all supposed to be in this direction. We're all supposed to be for the goal of setting our life apart unto the Lord and be used of Him. Leaders, of course, should be models in this. Not self-willed. That is intolerant or arrogant, stubborn-hearted, you know, one who's got his own agenda. He's going to do his own thing. And he basically just uses people to finish his agenda. Not quick-tempered or not contentious. He doesn't have an axe to grind. You know, he's not pushy. Some people just love to argue and, you know, argue over everything. When you get someone like that, they make poor leaders. Because they basically just bolster up themselves to win an argument and really not really be an example to a person. So not quick-tempered, not given to wine. Now, according to the Bible, you know, the Bible says wine makes the heart glad. And in the Old Testament, even in the New Testament, when you see the example here, of course, I don't believe that wine in those days was mere grape juice, but I also don't believe that it had the same alcohol content that it has today. There was certain examples for its use. In fact, Paul even told Timothy to take a little wine for his stomach's sake. In certain places, you know, you don't have the advantage of having things that you can, little pills you can put in your water and kill all those parasites. So Paul advised him, hey, look, you know, in that respect, take a little wine. There, you know, use it as a medicine. And that's really the limitation as a leader, as a church leader, in any respect, is to avoid wine, except in the sense of medicine. Of course, we don't need it as a medicine today. We've got other medicines that we can use. But Proverbs 31 speaks, it's not for kings. It's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, because it affects your judgment. The word temperate from the Greek means watchful and alert. And the idea here is just being wise in that. A drinker has no place, in my opinion, in ministry. Think of the ruined lives, the fatal accidents, the broken homes resulting from ethyl alcohol, all because of that little drink. Aren't you freer to say, you know, why do I need it? Some of you might be thinking with a mentality like, well, you know, what are you telling me? That you, I can't do this? Well, I don't like that. I resent that. You know, I think I'm free to have a drink now and then. And you know what? If that's the direction you're going to take it, well, you know, what can I say to that? I think you would rather benefit from an attitude that says, you know what, let me think about this for a second. Do I really need it? As I'm walking with the Lord and I'm experiencing Him and walking in His Spirit, why do I need to come under the influence of anything else? Why do I need to? Now, of course, some would argue, well, you know, you're under the influence of caffeine when you have too much chocolate, or you're under the influence of, you know, this or that, you know. And yes, I guess your foods in many respects could have some influence on you. You eat too much junk food, it's not going to help you very much. But you know, there's a wisdom in this also, because there is not just the sense of its effect on you, but it's also the effect on others. There is a stigma there. I know as a young Christian, you know, learning this from another angle, you know, I took that position. Hey, I'm free to have a beer every now and then. It's no big deal. I'm not going to get drunk. And so I would go into the bar with my friends and I'd have a beer and I'd try to talk to them about the Lord. I thought it was okay, you know. I didn't know. Till one time, one of the persons that I was talking with said, you know, why should I listen to you talk about God? You're sitting there with a beer in your hand. Like, what has it done for you? I was like, well, I'm not getting drunk. And they go, yeah, all right. Okay. You know, well, that really went over well. I just realized my effectiveness isn't there. It's gone. And the Lord was speaking to me, you know, see, you don't need it. And it was, and I'll tell you, it was a very freeing day in my life when I finally realized, you know, I don't need it. It's cool. I don't need it. But I don't get really fuddy-duddy, you know, and if I'm at a non-believer's home or helping them out or something and they say, hey, you want a beer? And I go, oh, I don't drink beer myself, you know. I don't put on this air, you know. I say, no, thanks. You know, you got some water? I'm not going to make a big deal out of it. But at the same time, I'm not going down that road because I don't want to be given to wine. Not violent is another qualification. Must be self-controlled, cool, calm, gentle, gracious, not holding grudges, bitterness, pardons failure. You know, there's this idea here. Not greedy for, notice, money. Ooh, this is a big one. You know, it's funny. Billy Graham used to say this all the time in his pastor's conferences. He'd say, men, money, pride, and women, one day will be your downfall if you're not walking and you're not honoring the Lord with your life. Because those are the main pitfalls that so happen to leaders in the church. Money, pride, and women. Deadly, deadly. Beware. Now, not greedy or fond of money is very important. The idea here is not being covetous. Not, you know, are you giving more attention to your money and your stocks and your gain than you are to people? What's on your mind more? Is it people or is it things? The material wealth or is it people? Love of money is the root of, or really the heart of a lot of false teachers, as we're going to find in the next passage. You know, their desire for dishonest gain and their need for gain in some respects, or making a quick buck or thinking of ways to bilk money out of people, is always the motivation for someone that uses religion to get that goal. In fact, religion is a very powerful motivator for people to give up some of their earned money. And there are charlatans out there that know that. They know how to extract funds from people. They know how to say all the spiritual words. I think of like the Tiltons in the world who, you know, and the people that are get on TV and they have such a smooth way of communicating and they seem so charismatic and so bubbly for Jesus. And you know, but you watch the bottom line. You watch what it all leads to. It all leads to a big fundraiser. You know, we're raising funds for this, or we've got this, or we need this, and we're going to do, we've got this big vision for God. Won't you come and help us? You know, the point is, you got to be wise in this respect. But unfortunately, even very godly men who have been raised up and used of the Lord have fallen victim to begin thinking more of money and things than people that they're called to. I think it was said of Jimmy Baker. In the beginning, he used money to reach people. But then somewhere along the line, he used people to reach money. And that became his goal. There are always going to be false prophets. Beware. But this is the problem. In fact, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 1 and 3 says, there are false prophets who and false teachers will be among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And by covetousness, they will exploit you with deceptive words. That's how it works. Deceptive words. Now, Paul was free from this. You know, when he spoke to the elders in Acts, he was free from it. He says, I've desired no one's, I've coveted no one's silver or gold. I don't care, I don't want it. And you know how my own hands have worked and I've labored and I've done and I've, you know, earned what I've gotten. And you saw the example. You know, they did. They saw the example. They knew that he wasn't in for, you know, the loot. In fact, and there was a little thing that they sent among the early church called a didacte, which was something that exposed certain people. They said, yeah, if a prophet comes in your town and he proclaims, you know, let's have a great feast. The Lord, thus saith the Lord, let's have a great feast. And he eats of that feast, he's a false prophet. It says if he comes with a way to say that God is saying something and he benefits from it, then there's a problem. It is a very difficult line. And you have to be careful. And I sometimes am sensitive in that area because I don't want to abuse my power in that respect and benefit as a result of the calling more than I should. And especially as an elder, it's important not to use your position. You know, anytime someone comes and they want to present a seminar, they want to do something for the church, they say, you know, well, this service will be great for the church. I always ask as a test, I'll say, well, the main test for doing that, whether it be a seminar for this or a seminar for that, as long as no one personally benefits from this, then you can go ahead and do it. Let's do it. That'll be great. Oftentimes, there's not a way that they can separate that. Because if it's, you know, training people and how to handle their finances, or if it's giving some, you know, thing and how to teach people and getting insurance, you know, ultimately there's going to be that link to purchase insurance or a seminar, this or that, from a person, and someone's going to benefit from it. And that's where it becomes a conflict of interest, because greed can come in. The love of money is very, very difficult. You know, God hardened us against ourselves in this respect. So he says this. Now, also goes on to say in verse 8, but hospitable. Now he gets to the positive side. So, you know, the negative side is there, but now there's a positive side. What are qualities that are very important in a person that is going to be used of the Lord in this capacity as an elder or an overseer? One is hospitality, literally meaning a love of strangers. He's got a love of strangers. It's not so much in entertaining friends, but in helping the unhelped. It's distributing needs of the saints, given to hospitality, as Romans 12, 13 says. And Paul tells us, don't forget to entertain strangers, for by doing so, some have actually unwittingly entertained angels. You know, you've always heard the story of someone who picked up a hitchhiker and, you know, they helped him out, and next thing you know, they disappeared, you know. And I've heard those stories, and I want to tell you something. I don't discount all of them because I think it's very possible that they're there. But let me warn you about hitchhikers these days. Be wise. Don't be naive. I got all over my wife one time when she picked up a hitchhiker, and she picked up this guy, you know. And, of course, she said he was an elderly guy, but I said, you know, you don't know. I know you don't want to be paranoid. And she says, well, the Lord spoke to my heart. And I said, well, how can you argue against that? All right, I'm not going to go down there. Just be wise, you know, because it's a different world. There are many other contexts by which you can help people than putting yourself in danger. But there is a love there for hospitality. And, you know, the Lord gives us this teaching on that. He speaks about, you know, in Luke chapter 14. In fact, turn to Luke 14 for a second, because I think this is a great illustration. Luke 14. Verse 12, he said to him who invited him, when you give a dinner or a supper, Do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives, your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just. You know, just an example here. Really, especially in those days, because of persecution, poverty, many orphans and widows, hospitality was the best expression of love. In those days, there weren't any hotels. There weren't any ways that people had. There wasn't a welfare system that could pick up and help where a lot of these people were. It was dependent upon individual people that had a hospitality, had a love for strangers to help them out in need. And it's so important. Today, you know, due to the economy and people getting married older and transient people, it is also essential. But we can reach people in different ways, and we have to be wise, of course, with broken loaves. This is one avenue of hospitality and love of strangers that we've used. Not only is it a blessing to those needy in this church whom we encourage to use the food and the resources that are there and the clothing, but also it's an overflow to many people that we don't know and have no strings attached, just to help them out and hopefully be encouraging them also spiritually. So hospitality. Also, notice, a lover of what is good. He's got a love for what's good. You know, I think there is a negative side in this too, where you want to refrain from those things that are not good. You know, being careful what you watch on TV and where you put your heart and what things you enjoy. You want to love those things that are good. Also notice, sober-minded. Now here is the idea of also self-control. In classical Greek, it's contrasted with a self-indulgent man who desires what he wants. So this implies someone that's chaste, discreet, moderate, sober, thoughtful. He's self-controlled in his thought life. And, you know, and I think that's a very, very important point. Where is your thought life? What do you dwell on? The Bible says in Philippians 4, whatever things are pure, whatever things are just, whatever things are true, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. If you are raised with Christ, seek those things above where Christ is seated. So a lover, you know, one being sober-minded, he can't be one who is prone to act on impulse or make rash and irrational decisions. You've got to be prudent and wise in this respect. Think things through. Also just, one who is just and fair. He's not going to be partial. He's, notice, not only just, but next word is holy. One who is set apart unto the Lord, an earnest desire to be pleasing to God. His attitude and actions reflecting a devotion to God, placing a high priority on the spiritual reality of things. Self-controlled. So you, in many respects, you have each one of these characteristics involve self-control, involve keeping your own life under control, watching over the issues from your own heart, knowing yourself well enough to not put yourself into situations that are going to tempt you beyond your ability to resist, just being wise, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict it. Let's think about this for a second, and then we're going to try to finish up on this point. Here's a guy who's coming in. He's got this desire to be an example among these people who are really rough. And he's got to find these guys that are qualified to this degree among these very rough Cretans, tall order, as you can see. But now, the ultimate goal of these guys, I believe, is to be able to, with sound doctrine, both exhort and convict those who contradict. He's got to, with wisdom, know the scriptures well enough to be able to refute false doctrine, to be able to refute a lot of the false ways. And there, of course, he goes on to say in verse 10, there are many insubordinate and both idle talkers and deceivers. Hey, that is true today. You know, I think of some of the things that people get caught up into in Christian circles. It blows my mind. I look at some of these programs on Christian television and it's like, oh, gag me. I can't believe it. It's embarrassing. There's a ministry, actually, I think it's called The Door. You know, they've got a web page, and they kind of expose a lot of these pseudo-Christian ministries. and they expose a lot of the false stuff in it. And I was watching this one video by this group, and you know, they were doing a lot of the, you know, the weird stuff, you know, like the new thing is the slouching in the Lord, you know. So you're in there praising the Lord, and all of a sudden you kind of just get drunk in the spirit, so to speak. And you start kind of just slouching down, you know. It's like you're supposedly worshiping the Lord, and you're falling into under the influence of the Spirit. So now under the influence of the Spirit, they thought they were drunk and act, so therefore we're going to act drunk. And so this is what they're doing. And I'm watching this couple, you know, at the very end of this video. They're slithering down their chair, and they slide off their chair, and they go right on the floor, and they're all like got this goofy look on their face. And I look and I go, that's my cousin. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. I can't wait to talk to him because I haven't seen him in a long time. Over 20 years ago, I got together with him because I saw him getting involved with this, you know, so-called faith ministry, and it was just a real weird connection. And I went and heard a message of his, and I was like, it just didn't sound right. I mean, I was young at that time. I was just 3-4 years old in the Lord, and I didn't know, but I knew that wasn't right. And so I shared with him then, and of course it wasn't well received, but now I see where it's all led to, and I, you know, if we ever get together in a family reunion, it's going to be interesting. But I couldn't believe it. But you know, it's like, what stops people? I mean, from holy laughter to, you know, barking like animals and making a lot of other animal sounds, and you know, all I can picture is someone coming up with this new thing like, well, in the Spirit, we're all free, and, you know, we're really clothed with light, so we don't need these clothing. And next thing you know, people are going to be stripping in the Lord, you know what I mean? And you'd be surprised how many weird things. There's probably a false teacher who's going to hear this on radio, and they're going to go, ooh, that's a good idea. I'd really bring in a crowd, let me tell you. But amazing what people will follow. Idle talkers is an interesting thing. Idleness, my grandmother used to tell me, is a devil's workshop. When you're idle, a person who is idle opens himself up to a whole lot more temptations than a person who's busy. That's just the way it is. You know, if you're struggling with drugs or alcohol and you're trying to overcome these things and you're unemployed, that's a dangerous combination. That's a dangerous combination. If you've got a lot of idle time, a lot of time on your hands, hey, you know what? Get busy. Do something. If you can't find something, you know, then chase after something. Do something. Even if you don't have, even if you can't work for the amount of money that you wanted to, do something. Because the danger of just being idle is much worse than earning a little bit less money than you thought you could earn if you, you know, or you should earn type of thing. But there are many insubordinate. They're not willing to come under authority. They don't like authority. They chafe under authority. Who are you to tell me what's right? And that type of thing. They're idle talkers, deceivers, especially those of the circumcision. Now, this was a particular group in Paul's day. These guys were coming, and they had kind of the Jewish groups that were there were still clinging to the old Judaism, and they felt that everybody had to be circumcised before they could become Christians. Titus was one that Paul purposely refused to have circumcised because he realized that it wasn't by circumcision. It was by the grace of God. And he points out in one of his other letters that, see, even Abraham was called while he was yet uncircumcised. And then he was circumcised as a seal, but he was made righteous and declared righteous before he was circumcised. And so Paul says, you know, these guys of the circumcision are coming along and they're trying to interject all these laws. You know, now there are groups that tend to be very legalistic. You know, Seventh-day Adventist groups can be very legalistic. Now, there can be some nice people in those groups, but boy, I tell you, they hold on to the law. They hold on to the seventh Sabbath day and then all the precepts that go along with that. And they yet pick and choose which laws they want to follow, unfortunately. So they're not consistent. But it all comes down to this. It's Jesus died for us and we must follow these rules and regulations. That's not how you're saved. Jesus died for you. You're saved by grace. As a result of being saved, now your life will change, but you're not looking to the law. The righteous requirement of the law is fulfilled in you. So he says, these guys, beware of them especially, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole households, teaching things which they ought not for the sake of dishonest gain. You know, there's two ways to really get people to part with their money from a kind of a charlatan standpoint. One is to come up with some new gimmick that's going to really, you know, razzle and dazzle them. And so they're going, ooh, that's cool. And so you get all the looky-loos are going to go over here and follow this new wind. And there's another way is you can keep people in bondage. You can keep people attached to your organization, and that if you leave this church, well, you know, you're never going to make it. And you've got to keep giving, and you know, you've got to, and so they got you tied in type of thing. And it's very subversive. It's very subversive. There's not a freedom there. There's not a real joy in giving. There's not a real excitement. And you're thinking, hey, I'm really investing in the kingdom here, and I'm willingly doing this as unto the Lord. It's kind of like a forced thing. And then, of course, he reminds us, one of them, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. Epiphanes, the highly esteemed 6th century BC Greek poet, is the guy who actually characterized these guys as being this. So Paul is actually quoting this 6th century poet. He calls him a prophet, one of their own, said, they're always liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. And they said that 600 years ago, and then he says, this testimony is true. Therefore, rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith. That's the key. That's the ultimate goal. But notice how sometimes you have to deal with certain people. Some people are really stubborn, and they need to be rebuked soundly. You know, there are some people that are struggling with things, and you need to encourage them and be sensitive. But there are other people, you know, if they keep stubbornly doing the same things, you got to threaten them. You got to say, hey, you know what? If you keep living like that and you keep making that choice to be unfaithful in that area, then why are you still calling yourself a Christian? Because that's totally hypocritical. And you got to rebuke them. You know, I think, I'll tell you what, the kisses of an enemy are deceitful many times, but the rebukes and the blows of a friend are faithful. Faithful the wounds of a friend. When you know someone that's not living right and yet they're still coming here to Calvary and professing everything's fine, you rebuke them. You have the responsibility, of course, going in gentleness and meekness first, trying to win them. But if they're rebellious to it, there needs to be a sharp rebuke that they may be sound in the faith, not giving heed to Jewish fables and commandments of men who turn men from the truth. There were many other fables and many other things that came in. To the pure, all things are pure. But to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. And even their mind and conscience is defiled. You know, that's a good example about just being the pure, all things are pure. You know, you're looking at the pure side. You give people the benefit of the doubt, too. You know, you're not like people like to paint Christians as, you know, we're witch hunters. You know, we're looking out for every little evil thing we can point out in someone's life. That's not at all. To the pure, all things are pure. You're actually hoping for the best. You're believing for the best. You're loving people. You want the best. And you're treating people. I think it's great when I go and wherever I am in the gym in the morning or wherever I'm going to treat people as if they're part of my family. And, you know, to love them with that love that the Lord would want us to love people. And there's that purity there. And even if, you know, the language is flying over there, it's like it just flies over your head and you just keep loving people. And I think that has a great testimony, you know, to people in the world. But there are some who profess to know God, but in works they deny Him, being abominable, disobedient, and disqualified for every good work. There is that element. And this is what's very sad when it comes into the church. There is a profession. I know God. I believe God. I believe Jesus. But by their very deeds, they're really denying Him. So they're saying one thing, but doing another. And we've got to see the difference. And so Paul has given this tall commission to Timothy. You know, with these qualifications and this commission to go into Crete, appoint elders in this place, and then warns them that part of their role is to watch out for wolves. Watch out for the false. Rebuke them soundly. And realize that there will be those who profess to know God, but in works deny Him. And in Christianity today, there is a great segment of the church who, there's a professing church. When you read the newspapers and you go to the religious section and you see that, you know, so-and-so is going to have a bingo party or this or that, and you've got the church and all the social activities of the world, and I'm not putting a judgment on them for having those things by themselves, but what happens is the world views the church as this entity, this whole picture, when in reality the very church of God are those people who are set apart for Him. They're not those who are just professing, but those who are doing. those whose lives have been touched, whose lives have been impacted by the Lord. And you know, I'll tell you, I don't want dead religion to come in here at Calvary. I don't want just to go through the motions and be in a church. Because, you know, I grew up in a church that I felt that was what it was. It just, there wasn't a life there. There was a lot of hypocrisy. And you know what's sad when I hear, you know, there are situations here at Calvary that people are doing this and that. And you know what? There's where, as a body, we need a healthy body can deal with those elements. And that's important. You know, if someone feels uncomfortable because you've talked to them and they don't want to come back here anymore, you know, it might be a season of time to really pray for that individual, that they may come to see the error of their ways and repent and know that God's way is best. And we're not judges, but we are fruit inspectors. We need to really pray for one another. We can see whether there's fruit being produced, but we need to be for each other, not against each other, not aiming our Christian guns at people, you know, but rather winning people and being sensitive and gracious in those respects. It's the grace of the Lord.